There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott from sunny Bahrain, I believe. So big welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Hello, everyone from Bahrain. Yeah, it's lovely out here. Yeah, loving it. Whoops, sorry, not the laptop there. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, we've had, obviously, the much-anticipated budget yesterday. So just, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but just what were your sort of top-level thoughts on Rachel Reeves' statement? Was it a sort of like a precursor to a Santa rally for equities or a bit of a nothing burger?
I think it could be ingredients for a Santa rally, actually. I think we've been very clearly told by lots of companies and by talking to investors that kind of the fear of what might be in the budget put everything on hold for about 3 months. Personally, I was actually quite relieved. I don't think there were any bombshells in the budget, and a lot of the things we feared, like a cut to the 250k pension tax-free amount, didn't happen. Gaming sector's obviously being hammered, but everything that was announced has already been pre-announced, hasn't it? So I actually see it quite positively. I think we could well see a relief rally, and I started to see that in one or two of my shares I hold today, actually, some tentative buying. So yeah, I'm always glass half full, aren't I, Paul? So do you agree, or are you more sceptical?
Well, just on that gaming sector, I was just wondering what your thoughts were, because obviously Rank Group yesterday, which is the casino business, but basically went up yesterday and then came down like a pack of cards because it came out with a trading, you know, basically statement. It was quite surprising how much the Gaming Corporation share prices hadn't actually incorporated what the actual you know, the increase in the online duty. Any sort of quick thoughts on sort of like Rank or gambling at all?
Yeah, I looked at all five of them actually this morning in my Substack. So running through them, Flutter, they announced a hit to their profits of about 6% of EBITDA. So that will be a bit more at the PBT level, maybe 10% off their earnings, which is surprising given how big it is, and that's international. Terrible, terrible balance sheet at Flutter. Entain, they have got an even worse balance sheet, I would say. Just appalling. I'm red on both of those. And they say it's going to be about an 8% hit to their EBITDA. These are annualized. We have, what are the others? We have all five of them report, didn't we? Playtech, they said almost no impact, or they said they can recoup it with outperformance in other territories. So I think that's a slightly different business model at Playtech. But anyway, they're kind of not impacted. Rank, terrible, absolute disaster. I know they went up yesterday because of the removal of the bingo duty, but the after-hours update from Rank yesterday was appalling. It's basically going to wipe out pretty much all their profits, although they haven't got balance sheet problems, so it's not terminal. So that was, I'm surprised it wasn't down more than 10% today when I last looked. I think Rank is the one that's an absolute disaster. It's going to wipe out 2/3 of their forecast profit going forward. And the last one, what was the last one, Paul? Can you remember? Evoke. Now, I think this is close to insolvent. I have to say the balance sheet there is diabolical and it's a big hit to their profit. So out of that lot, I think Rank and Evoke are the ones that are the worst hit. So I don't know if you've looked at them, Paul. Have you?
Yeah, I mean, the ones which haven't sort of moved were Gaming Realms, which is obviously a bit...
Oh, yes.
Which is a Slingo. And I don't know whether... I know they changed their the betting duty for online gambling, but I think they took it down for bingo. So I don't know where Slingo actually lies, whether it's between slots or bingo. But it's more of a sort of a Playtex similarity. It's off the software side. And then the...
Software, yeah. Yeah, I don't think Gaming Realms should be affected much at all by this, actually. So, yeah.
Yeah, and then we also had a question from Tim, actually, asking about Winvia Entertainment, the recent IPO, which I think you know a lot about, because it used to be the best of the best, didn't it? And then has added on an online casino in Romania, I think.
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't got around to looking at this one yet, so I wouldn't want to say anything, because a friend told me that apparently it's changed a lot from the days that it was best of the best. So I probably better not comment on that as I haven't really properly looked at it. So don't know for Winvia, I'm afraid.
Yeah. All I would say just on the pricing of Winvia, it trades at about, it's a punchy 21 times PE, but it only is a 5.5 times EBITDA, which says to me they've got leverage. They can increase those EBIT margins in the fullness of time to get to more industry standards. But I don't think it's massively expensive, but it needs to put out its first results, doesn't it, given it's a recent IPO.
Yeah, I mean, when it was BOTB, it left a pretty bad taste. What happened there, I won't regurgitate all of that, but I personally, I'm not interested. I wouldn't go near it, but
Okay, and then the other one on the budget that Mandy was asking about actually was Unite. I know we've talked about it, the students one, and they came in the budget. They've put in a £950 fee for international students, which comes into effect in 2028. And I know you made a really perceptive observation the last time we talked about it, which was that there was a very large percentage occupancy of Chinese students in Unite halls of residence, but also just overall in internationals. So this could be a real headwind in 2 to 3 years' time for this whole sector. I think Unite, aren't they emerging with Empiric? I think anyway, quick thoughts from yourself.
Well, the only news I've got on Unite today was an update on the CMA investigation, the Competition and Markets Authority, saying that they were going to have a hearing on the 26th of January to look at the takeover. But I didn't pick up anything else about the student fees. So, no, I'm not aware on that. I mean, you've got a very nice dividend yield, about 7%. On Unite, maybe a little bit of a question mark over the property valuations, which we've covered before, and possible oversupply. So, but that's all I've got on that one, really, Paul.
Yeah, I would, over the sector on the students, I'd be very cautious about these halls of residence, because I think if that stays, I know it's a consultation from the government, but if they put a fee of £1,000 extra on the universities, it's going to obviously deter a lot of international students from coming here, isn't it? Which is, I suppose, is what they want. Mm-hmm. They don't want the students staying here, do they, for the immigration figures? But hey, I mean,
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the fees they charge on the foreign students are basically bankrolling the whole further education sector, aren't they? So
yeah.
I think we're lucky to have them here paying $24,000 a year fees, I would suggest, pumping money into the economy. So actually, there was just an interesting point as well. The government and the civil service don't seem to be aware of the fact that when they put jack up taxes, it changes behaviour. And that was interesting in the 5 updates from the gambling companies today, who all said the same thing. They will now have to cut back drastically on marketing spending. They call it mitigation. So you'll see spillover for this with marketing companies now, who will suffer from reduced revenue from gambling companies. They'll have to close some sites. There'll be thousands of job losses. So the government will lose PAYE and national insurance. So there'll be a whole range of spin-off benefits. And they all, I think nearly all of them, mentioned that the unlicensed illegal betting firms will now have a big surge in activity. And a couple of them pointed to when similar tax rises happened overseas, the tax take actually dropped because people switched to unregulated, untaxed gaming companies. So I think you could see a whole range of sort of spin-off collateral damage, if you like, from these large hikes in the gaming duties. Maybe they've overdone it. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, they've had a track record, haven't they, of not being able to look round corners and see what the behavioural changes and sentiment changes is going to be. I think.
Sorry, I've just got to plug in my computer.
Okay. I think big picture wise, I think they've just missed a great opportunity because there was nothing on growth, there was nothing on entrepreneurship, there was nothing about starting new businesses and wealth creation and moving forward in the new sort of tech climate, and it was very much just
there was talk about that, but no meaningful measures, was there? They did mention a 3-year stamp duty holiday for new IPOs, I think, which it's fiddling around the edges though, isn't it? There were no big things to stimulate the economy for sure.
I was hoping for something on housing because that's a big multiplier effect. I was hoping something about sort of like, you know, new companies and entrepreneurs and this sort of stuff. Absolutely zero. It was a classic old Labour tax and spend type budget, which was a bit of a shame because I, as I say, when they first came into office, I was hoping it was going to be a new Labour Blair and Brown type scenario, but it's so far from that. It's just not there at all.
Yeah, I mean, she did mention in passing extra resources for local authority planning departments to unblock the 2 to 3 year or more even delays that we were talking to MJ Gleeson about. So at least I think they're trying to do some things that are good, but we all knew we were all going to get clobbered and investors are going to have to pay a bit more, you know, buy-to-let landlords are going to have to pay a bit more tax and whatnot. But I didn't see anything in it that's going to derail the stock market, companies other than gaming companies. And of course, the bond market, the forex markets took it quite well. That's really important as well. And the measures to reduce inflation by freezing rail fares and cutting energy bills, they've twigged, I think, that the previous things they did stoked inflation, which then causes huge pay rises for all the public sector workers. So they're kind of learning on the job, and there's some signs that they're actually beginning to learn one or two things. But So overall, look, I think we've got to be fair. It could have been a lot worse, couldn't it?
Yeah, you're right. It could have been a lot worse. Okay, good. Let's move on to some questions. We've got Philly's asking about Global Data, which is a bit of a fallen angel in the B2B information sort of market research data provider sector. I mean, basically, I think as an example, what it effectively does is provide research reports on sectors, on trends, on industries for companies, particularly, say, in the healthcare. I don't know what your thoughts are. The shares have absolutely been, well, cut in half, I think, over the last sort of like 3 or 4 years. Looks relatively good value at the moment.
Yeah, that's what we thought. We looked at this on Monday. My colleague John wrote up a section on it. He said to me, Paul, I can't believe how cheap this thing is. But we had a bit of internal discussion on it, because I agree on the numbers. It looks very, very cheap, and it's doing a buyback, and you know, PE is only about 10, all this sort of thing. And it's owner managed, and it's got an acquisitive strategy. But the trouble is, and you might be able to help on this, the RNS was sort of portraying it as a software company, but one of the readers, we were discussing it with my readers on my Substack, and they were saying, no, it's more a publishing company. So I think it depends we need to look into more detail about what it actually does, the hands-on activity. So you're saying it's more of a publishing company, are you, Paul?
It's more of an information platform. So if, let's just say, for instance, you are you're a healthcare company in biotech, and you want a research report in some immune disease, etc., then these guys will be able to tell you all about the key players. They'll tell you about the growth rates. They'll also be able to say what the sort of the main drivers of value in that particular area are. So it's a walled garden of proprietary data that companies and academics and research and professionals will use. So it could sell some of the data if it wanted to AI, to the large language, but I don't think it wants, at the moment, I don't think it wants to, and it'll basically have its own AI language model over the top to be able to service those type of questions, plus obviously continue to sell those sort of research reports to companies. But it makes marvelous margins.
I mean, I was looking at it.
It's about 35% EBIT margins, and they're hoping to get that back up to 40%. Plus, I think it traded about 8x EBITDA. Now, 2 years ago, if I remember rightly, I believe that had a big private equity partner come in. I think it was Inflexon, who basically bought 40% of their healthcare practice on a 16x EBITDA, so double of what it currently lies. And of course, Global Data still own this other 60%. So it says to me there actually is a pricing arbitrage opportunity here. It doesn't seem. Having said that, though, I think the CEO did sell, about 20 million shares in that tender offer, which was at 150, which happened a few weeks ago. So it's a sort of like a difficult one to a certain extent, but it does look a high quality business.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, just purely looking at the numbers, the historical numbers, we were really impressed. And John said, my colleague, you know, he said, I think I might actually buy some of these. I held back and said, I think we need to learn more about what it actually does. And obviously, quite a few of my readers were saying, this is the sort of thing that AI could absolutely just gun for and produce the bare bones of a report, you know, quickly, simply, and basically at zero cost. Yeah, and the founder, CEO, Michael Thomas, holds 60%. So I think it's definitely something that I need to find out more about, because the numbers definitely look attractive, don't they? Attractive value.
Yeah, I mean, hey, we'll wait and see. Okay, good question. Right, let's move on. We've got Stephen Griffiths is asking about GB Group, which is a company we've talked about a lot. It does the effectively works in sort of like ID verification and location. Came out with results, I think, first half, which were in line. What was your sort of take? The shares responded pretty well, actually, I think, on the day.
Yeah, we think this is a potential trade. I'm just looking it up. Yeah, Tuesday this week, 25th. Let me do Control F, G, B, G. Here it is. It was interim results, wasn't it? I'm sorry, it's not coming up on my thing. Basically, we think it's cheap. it had quite a lot of debt. But if you look at the last two or three years, it took on all this debt for an acquisition. It's actually paying it back quite rapidly, which I love to see that, because that's telling you this is actually genuinely cash generative. Right, found it. H1 results. Revenue was flat. EBIT was flat as well. Additional 10 million buyback announced. Okay, that's only about 2% of the market cap. And March 26, in line with market expectations. So no great shakes there. Yeah, my colleague Dave looked at this. Forward PE is only 12.7x. Cheap for the sector, could be an acquisition target. I think you've mentioned that before. So we gave this 4 out of 5 stars. We like it, GB Group. Wouldn't be surprised to see somebody, you know, say an American group table a bid for it, possibly. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, the one thing which is always, I've always scratched my head on it, and I've got a thesis that I haven't been able to verify, is that the market is currently growing at about organically 10% per annum. And these guys on a like-for-like are only doing about 1% or 2% at best. And I think their product is very good, but I do believe on a historical basis, it may be currently priced quite high. So what they're seeing is they're getting their market share as they've always had in terms of volume of being able to verify a particular individual for a bank to be able to onboard that particular person. Again, they're staying the same number of transactions, but they're having to actually be more competitive on pricing, which is acting as a drag on their like-for-like sales. So I think they're readjusting. And if that's correct, it means once that runs its way through, which hopefully will be towards the back end, start of next year or back end of next year, then they should be able to then carry on growing. So this could just be a wait and see story, and does sort of like underline what you've said in terms of, you know, if that is the case, then somebody will put a number on him and take advantage of what they're doing.
Mm. I mean, I wonder, yeah, that all makes sense. I mean, they were £2.41 when we looked at them on Tuesday, I think it was. Have you got the current price on GB Group?
Yeah, it's £2.55.
Oh, okay, so it's bounced a bit, yeah. It sounds to me like the type of situation where it might be all about product innovation as well, mightn't it? If as I think you've mentioned before, there are four or five big competitors, what can it do to get a step ahead of the competition? Maybe that might be a good thing to research, find out about what product, you know, developments they're doing, because you don't want to be in a race to the bottom on price type of situation, really, do you? Which it might sounds like it might be going that way. I don't know, but I mean, optically, I mean, the value metrics on it do look attractive, providing it's not, you know, a declining business, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, good. Let's stay in the same sort of tech sector. We've got Deborah. She's asking about Spectra Systems. Didn't they come out with they came out with an announcement, didn't they, or something like that? That they just won a new contract.
Yeah, this one is one of mine. I mean, it just shows they always say back your winners, don't you? So I did, because I thought this was a fabulous stock. And it's just gone down and down and down. We did have a profit warning from it, though, not long ago, which was handled very badly. They kind of tried to finesse it away, but then slip it out through the broker. It was for 2026, large lumpy contracts, unfortunately, and they had a couple of quite big delays. So, and then just in the intervening sort of silence, just a constant dribble of people selling. I think it's really heavily oversold now. So I've more than doubled my position size in this over the in several chunks over the last few months. Here we are, I found it. We had a contract win yesterday, a five-year contract win for banknote sensors, which is its key specialism, over 5 years. One of my contacts reckons this might be the Fed, the Federal Reserve, which is an existing client, of course, and it should have a load of cash coming in the not too distant future from the major sort of every 10-year type contract that is currently underway. I think the shares are way oversold, I have to say, and you get lovely divvies, really, really good long-term track record. So I'm staying strong and long, as they say, on this one, and just keeping my fingers and toes crossed that there's not some awful news that is being withheld from us, because that's what you always worry about, isn't it, when you see a relentlessly declining share price, and sometimes some awful news comes out, but sometimes it doesn't. So I don't know, it's in the lap of the gods at the moment, but I think it's a very, very nice company. So my view on the fundamentals hasn't changed at all, really.
Yeah, now it's got a good balance sheet. It's got cash on it. And then it's, you know, just in terms of the revenue, do you know how much is recurring? I know obviously they've just got that recurring revenue stream from services. Any sort of thoughts? Is it a third?
I don't have that number at my fingertips, Paul, I'm afraid. Yeah. There is an element of multi-year contract wins, I think. But I'm not going to blag it. I'm not sure is the answer, but yeah, okay. There are notes available. I think you can get research notes on Research Tree, so you can look up that sort of thing. I'm really backing the entrepreneur here. It's run by a group of guys who are just brilliant innovators, and basically every new product line they launch seems to work. So it's one of those type of situations. You just back it for 5-10 years, and you know, and it multibags. Just hope it can keep doing it.
Okay, good. Let's move sector. We've got retail online. We've got Paul the Parrot. He's asking about Boohoo. That the shares are up 40% today, admittedly from a very low position, but I think they released some results, and they say that they claim that their turnaround is happening, and the debt was a bit lower as well. But what was your take?
I'm skeptical, I have to say. I mean, I was a big fan of Boohoo when it was growing, you know, exponentially and throwing off huge amounts of cash. But the business model has completely changed because of Chinese competition. You did have a thing in the budget yesterday where Rachel Reeves has apparently says she's closing the loophole, and now imported parcels of any value will be subject to duty. So when I heard that in the budget, I thought to myself, oh, I should probably buy some Boohoo shares. I think they're about 11 or 12p, and now they're 17p. So I think there might be a bit of that, of a trade for what that happened. Also, the H1 results came out today to September, talking up EBITDA, talking up the turnaround. But when you dig into the numbers, it's still loss-making. And it's got a fragile balance sheet with negative net tangible asset value. So it doesn't, too much debt, it doesn't stand up to scrutiny when you dig into the numbers. There was also a positive exceptional income this year and a huge negative exceptional cost last year. So you take those out and it's still losing about 18 million loss before tax in H1. So I'm sceptical. I need a lot more evidence of an actual turnaround because there's a gulf between the loss before tax and the positive EBITDA because of finance costs and heavy capitalization of IT spend. So I'm sceptical. I think today's 40-odd% rise is probably a bit spurious. They did bring in as well a very generous management reward scheme. However, and they've refused to put it to a shareholder vote because apparently they're not required to. But actually, I read the RNS about that and I don't begrudge them that. It's linked to the share price. Basically, the bottom rung of it is about tripling the share price or doubling or at least. And then it just pays out on a ratchet, you know, up to, I think, £3 a share, which is obviously pie in the sky. But and the dilution on it wasn't that bad. It was, I think, something like 5%. So a lot of people were bellyaching about that management reward scheme. Personally, I thought it was okay. And we also have Panmure and Zeus raising the forecasts today, but still negative EPS. So it's got a long way to go, is all I would say.
Yeah, I think the only thing I don't like about really, when I say aggressive or egregious type management incentive schemes, which are just linked to the share price, is that it changes behavior of the management team, because it comes a situation right, whereby effectively they're playing with your money. And if they get if they throw the dice and they get a double six, then everybody goes to the moon. Everybody has a great time, and they particularly. But if it's less than six, then you lose, the shareholder loses, but they go away with a salary, and you just think, okay, well, it's a classic sort of like heads we both win, but tails I don't lose, you know, the management don't lose, but the shareholders do, you know. It's one of those, it isn't quite up and down.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, for me personally, as long as the things I hate are zero cost options and, you know, massive dilution, and sort of, you know, soft targets, 10-15% EBITDA growth, or all they do is make an acquisition on funded by debt and you've got your numbers. So I like it being linked to the share price, and I thought the 5%-ish dilution was acceptable, actually. So personally, and I think, why not spin the dice? You know, the shares peaked at £3 and are now 11p yesterday. I think just go for it. See if you can multi-bag it, and why not?
Yeah, I've seen too many greedy incentive schemes which basically have blown companies up. So it hasn't been...
true.
You know, but anyway, such a life.
No, okay, I do take your point, Paul, but yeah. I think you can look at it either way, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got Richard Leppington. He's asking about how long should he persevere with pets at home? He says the vets part looks good, but the retail has been a disaster. He'd appreciate your thoughts there, Paul. Any comments?
Yeah, well, we had results yesterday. Yes, he's quite right. The retail size has been a disaster. We've had two profit warnings in the last year or two. And actually, when the H1 results came out yesterday, the shares went up. So that was encouraging. I think we're at or near the bottom now. The vet, he quite rightly says, the vets business is doing really well. And as I reported yesterday in the H1 results, the retail side of the business was barely above break even, but the vets business made something like £45 million PBT, and it's growing its profits. So yeah, the retail side of the business is worth virtually nothing, which did surprise me that the retail side has got that bad. But you're right, your valuation now is pretty much underpinned by the vets business alone. So I would say it's copper bottomed at around this level. All the bad news is in the price, and your vets business is worth the market cap. So they need to, I think they fired the CEO, so they're waiting for a new CEO. I see more upside than downsides, which is why I continue to hold for those reasons. But yeah, obviously it has been a disappointment, but we know that's already known. I think it's quite a credible turnaround. Very cash generative still. Ungeared balance sheet. You know, there's quite good dividend yield. There's a lot to like here, even though long-suffering shareholders might disagree. Yeah, the fundamentals are not broken. They just need a turnaround on the retail side, I would say.
Yeah. Well, how do you sort of like view just sort of like CEO changes and departures? Because we've had a flurry of them recently. We've had obviously the Pets at Home. We've had Hilton Foods. We've had what else we got? We got Domino's Pizza. Treat has just gone as well. I think we've had Marshalls as well. The sort of success rate of putting a new CEO in. I mean, how do you view it?
I don't know, Paul. Every situation is different, isn't it? I mean, all we can go by is what the CEO did in their last job, didn't they? I mean, you do look at some of these serial CEOs who seem to pop up at companies and you think, how the hell do they get these gigs, you know, when they're absolutely useless, some of these people. Oh, well, that's harsh, but you know, I'm not going to name obviously, but and the famous Buffett saying obviously that the reputation of a bad business will overcome even the best of CEOs, won't it? So I don't know. I mean, do you find there's a general one fit all rule? Because I can't say I do.
Yeah, really. The way I sort of like move it is such that I look at the business and I think, okay, can this actually be changed through self help measures? And if you do get an industry guru or somebody who really has got a lot of respect and has done a similar sort of turnaround job, then I'd big tick in the box. And you tend to find that from activist investors who inject a new CEO or a new exec chairman in, who knows somebody who can actually pull the relevant levers. But where you have a broken business, and I would pitch, I don't know, the retail side of Pepsi is a tough area to be in because you compete against all the online. Likewise, I'd pitch Boohoo in a tough area, even if you've got somebody who's really strong. But where it does sort of work more often than not is where you get the old founder who has been a massive success, who stepped away, who then comes back and just starts pulling the levers that he pulled before when he went through a hard time. And then it tends to work pretty well. But
that's a really good point. Yeah,
I'm hesitant most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think turnaround. You know, of the companies that do become good turnarounds, there are many more where the turnaround fails, I would say. I mean, I can't back that up with hard numbers, but it'd be an interesting thing to measure. Actually, I mean, a good example of a founder coming back and really turning it around quickly and effectively is the telematics company Quartix, QTX. That has been a good recent example of the founder coming back and just ditching all the initiatives of the predecessor and just saying, right, let's get back to basics. It's about margins, it's about growth, it's about cutting costs. And he really done a fantastic job in turning it around. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Look at the share. I'll just put the share price. The share price has done great, hasn't it? Which leads us perfectly into the same industry in telematics. Let's go to MicroLease, which is a bigger, I think it's a slightly bigger business, came out with a shocking profit warning earlier this week in terms of full year. I think quite a lot of it is, it does telematics and for HGVs and big fleets in the UK and also in for Europe and stuff. What was your take on it anyway?
I was shocked as well. I was really surprised by this. I've always pronounced it MicroLease. I don't know if that's the right pronunciation or not, but the ticker is SAAS. Now, I'd always assumed this was a recurring revenue business, you know, the market leader. Apparently, you're right, for fleets, apparently it has something like 60% of the UK market. It's been acquisitive as well. It's, I think, maybe it's not owner managed. I think I might have got that wrong. But anyway, I was very surprised. The strange thing was about this, the reasons it gave for missing the forecast were actually mentioned in the last Outlook statement in September. But It blamed a cyber attack on a major customer, which is obviously must have been Marks and Spencer's, I think. And also it said a further fall in OEM revenues in the automotive sector, which I'm assuming must mean installations for brand new trucks. I don't know if I've got that right or wrong, but it was a big, big drop in the forecast. Canaccord reduced the current calendar year forecast by 43%, which you really don't expect, do you, with 1 month to go for the financial year. So very, very surprising and disappointing. I think that's really ruled it out for me now as a potential investment, unfortunately. So have you got anything to add, Paul?
Yeah, I would just say, I mean, just on valuation, I think you're right. I mean, you know, it trades at still even, you know, 8x EBITDA, which is probably about the right kind of price. Because when you look at sort of like telematics, how fast should this grow? And you've probably... you've probably taken in the UK and Europe, there's probably most of the trucks have actually got some sort of like telematics, you know, and that fleet organized that. So, you know, it's more of a GDP type. I mean, it could have another sort of like, you know, growth leg if it does an acquisition into another area and then it can start getting some white space. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be, even though it's come down a lot and it's got a lot of recurring revenue streams, I wouldn't be rushing into it to buy it, even though I think
me neither.
Yeah.
No, I looked at it and ran my slide rule over it, and I was thinking probably 70, 80p looks a fair valuation to me after this bombshell warning, really. I can't see why you'd want to pay a quid for it. So, no, I've gone right off that one, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's go to sector. We've got building products. We've got Lorenzo. He's asking about Brickability. Came out with a trading update this week, did it or something? But anyway, what was your take on it? You own it, I think, don't you there, Paul?
Yeah, I do. I own this one. I mean, it keeps putting out really encouraging, in-line updates when all around in the sector are warning on profits. But the market just doesn't give it any credit for that, which I can't understand. I mean, to my mind, the valuation's nuts here. I just think bottom of the cycle earnings probably, and you've got a dividend yield that's higher than the PE. So I just don't understand it, why the market is so negative on this share. I'm just scrolling through trying to find it. The main negative point is the balance sheet. It is weakish. It's got 16 million negative net tangible asset value. But because it's a capital light business, Brickability mainly drop ships the bricks. So it doesn't actually take possession of the bricks. They're drop shipped from the manufacturer to the end customer, with Brickability kind of being the invoicing operation. And it's done some nice acquisitions as well. I believe it has a division that does cladding remediation, which I think it's doing quite well from. Maybe that side is mopping up the shortfall on the other side. I don't know. Seems very well managed. Yeah, here we are, H1 results to September. EPS was only down 2.2%, which I think, given how tough macro in the sector is, I thought that was very encouraging. They held the divvy unchanged, in line for the full year. I think I don't understand the valuation. I think this has got really good upside, providing, you know, as always, providing nothing goes wrong. But yeah, do you like it? You're still in Michelmersh, are you, Paul?
Yeah, I'm in Michelmersh, but I think this whole sector is massively underowned. And it's a matter of when the housing market and the building sector starts going again. And clearly the government need it for the multiplier effect for employment and to start generating, you know, sort of like GDP for the whole country. So I just think, and all of them, you know, Michelmersh, you've got Ipstock, Brickability, Fortera. We talked to Alamask last week. You've got Marshalls, and then all the house builders as well. All their valuations are on the knees. So it just says to me that it's hugely underowned, and that also smells opportunity, because we've both been through this before. At some point, the housing market and the building products market is going to come better. So as long as you've got patience and you're in a company with a decent balance sheet that can carry on, if you have to be patient, then it's a matter of when you're going to make money. It's not if.
I agree. And my colleague, Dave or John, I can't remember, one of them today was looking at another company. And I think it was it was James Latham and, I've gone blank. But anyway, real value type shares, you know. And they said, look, the market is pricing these things as if they're never going to recover. And you think, but they're cyclical companies. They've done self-help stuff throughout the downturn. Their margins are good. You know, they've got net cash balance sheets. So I think we've got some fantastic opportunities out there for people who are patient and, you know, have got the vision to see that, of course, at some point there's going to be green shoots. I mean, we've been saying that now for about 3 years, haven't we? And it always seems to sort of falter. But you're buying all the company's earnings in perpetuity when you buy a share. And I think UK small value shares are so out of fashion at the moment that all this liquidity driven selling, and for all the various reasons we've talked about ad nauseam, really, at some point that ends and sentiment turns, and you'll make some smashing profits, I think, if you're patient. And if you buy something that's got a 4%, 5%, 6% dividend yield, you're paid to wait. So I know I'm a stuck record on this, Paul, but I've seen that you have as well. We've been in this game 30 odd years. We've seen the same cycles, just the same patterns happen over and over again. And you've got to get in ahead of that change in sentiment, because they can go up 20 or 30% in a day. If there's some good news, you can get a takeover bid, you know. So, what share was it again?
I put on there is James Latham, because essentially what you raise a really good point, because one of the audience a couple of weeks ago did point out to me that one of its, James Latham, just for everybody, is a timber merchant, does sort of like a panel, timber panels for all buildings and construction and stuff like that. One of its biggest rivals went bust about four or 5 weeks ago, and I think it was National Distribution Center. Now, we've seen this story before, haven't we? Because there's been companies like Morgan Sindall. They've booked their office fit out took a really big leap upwards, and you should see their share price. It's gone to the moon on the back of ISG going bust about 2 years ago. You've had it Gear for Music, one of their competitors, have also gone bust. You're noticing it as well through in the carpet distribution with Likewise, aren't you, in terms of with Headlam. So actually, another catalyst may not be a takeover. It's one of your competitors goes out of business, and this could be really quite on it, you know, at a turning point for James Latham, because that company, National Distribution, I looked at it, and I think it makes about 100 million a turnover. So it's not a small business.
It's quite substantial. Yeah, you're right. One of my readers messaged me and pointed this out a few weeks ago. So we actually incorporated that today into our section on James Latham. And I think that's such a good point you made about market share. And the gambling companies, again, coming back to that, a couple of them said today the same point. They said this is going to drive smaller operators out of business, and we expect to gain from picking up market share. So, yeah, but as a general theme, that's such a good point, Paul. Yeah, really, really good.
Okay, good. We've got Ben Sharman. He's asking about Marston's, the pub chain in the UK. Came out with, I think it was a beat on the, and an upgrade going forward. Some good seasonal sales or forward order book or something. But anyway, what was your take on the pub chain Marston's?
Look, really good. Unfortunately, I was a bit slow on the uptake on this. This was Tuesday. The problem I've got with Marston's is it's got a very complicated, heavily geared balance sheet. So it's not something you can really dissect quickly. Here we are in our pre-8 a.m. Summary on Tuesday. We flagged that the results looked like a slight beat. And of course, when something is very highly indebted and it starts to perform well, as we saw with McBride a year or two ago, you can get that lovely leveraged effect on the share price, can't you? And it looks like that might be happening here. So yeah, I think Marston's definitely looks interesting for some further research. Yeah, and I think the research would mainly be balance sheet analysis, because it did have net debt of nearly 900 million. That was nearly 5x EBITDA. So you can't just ignore that debt. But I think it's got quite a lot of freeholds as well. So complicated. So it's the type of share probably needs a whole morning to go through. And I didn't get enough time to really properly look at it. Do you know it, Paul, Marston's?
Well, it's actually a Wolverhampton brewery and pub chain, you know. So it's just around my neck of the woods in the Black Country. Yeah, I mean, it's very, very popular and people like it. Well, it would be, wouldn't it, you know, sort of where I live. But, yeah, they seem to be. What was good was that if they're seeing an 11% increase for seasonal orders, it's probably a good bellwether in terms of the economy. Mm. And coming back to your original point in terms of we may be on a touch of a sort of like a Santa rally. If we get a good Christmas and the trading updates coming out of a lot of consumer-facing businesses are positive in January, the market will start sniffing that out early. So, you know, I'm with you. It didn't knock the ball out of the park, but the shares were up a good sort of like 10%, I think it was, on the day.
I think it was even higher, was it? Yeah. I think it might have been 20% on the day. Yeah, definitely. I mean, looking at the numbers here, the underlying PBT for the full year this was up 71% to 72 million quid. That's really good, isn't it? I wish I'd looked at these earlier, actually. the trouble is I'm trying to cover 800 companies. It's just ridiculous. But I think you're right. I mean, we talked previously about the budget, didn't we, and how it might make companies and individuals hold back. Well, my inkling is that in my sort of network of general friends, not friends in the financial markets, I think people looked at the budget and kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, we're going to pay a bit more tax, but nothing horrendous. So maybe households will now unlock the checkbooks a bit for Christmas. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it just as a case in point of anecdotal evidence. I mean, we've already done our sort of like a bulk Christmas alcohol buying through Tesco's online, so we're sort of like stormed it. But yeah, we were going to go out. There's plenty of time going out, but I think people will, as you say, it isn't really sort of like going to affect their disposable incomes in the near term anyway. Mm. The main thing is the jobs, isn't it? Is the job security
jobs. A lot of the budget measures were back ended, weren't they? Things like freezing the thresholds, sort of incrementally over 3, 4, 5 years, it helps the government supposedly balance the books, but it doesn't hit people in the pocket today. Now, plus we got the energy bills coming down £150 per household in April, supposedly. Rail fares frozen, I think, is a nice. Will give a nice little fillip to investor confidence, perhaps. So I think it wouldn't surprise me, Paul, if we get better than expected trading updates in January from retail-focused businesses. And people have got lots of savings and the savings rate is high. Maybe people might just on this narrative that everyone's skint, it's just not true. Obviously, some people are feeling the pressure. The vast majority of households are reasonably okay. That's what the data shows anyway. They wouldn't be saving 10-12% of their income if they weren't, would they?
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay, in the same sector, we've got Quest Aware. He's asking about ceramics company Churchill China, and I think these guys do is it plates and crockery for restaurants and for pubs and stuff. So if they're selling to Marston's, they're probably doing well anyway. But the shares haven't responded well at all. It's just what your latest view is on Churchill China.
Well, I bought a couple of tranches in this over the last year because I thought it was ridiculously cheap and it just keeps going down. So, I mean, based on the last trading update and the last set of numbers, I mean, it's very, very good value. But the market clearly, you know, is just anticipating more bad news, isn't it? So the beauty of it is it doesn't really matter how they're trading because it's got a bulletproof balance sheet. You don't have to worry about the company's finances at all. So for me, this I've just shoved in a bottom drawer and I'll just ride it out. I do worry a bit about cheaper competition, but the Churchill China, and people say, oh, you know, it's expensive to manufacture in the UK, but we know that's been a known factor for years, so there's nothing new there. They're just basically saying in the updates we get from it, they did warn on profits in July, just saying, you know, the sector's really tough. The problem is new restaurants are not opening up to the extent that we need them to be. But they do, of course, have repeat high margin business for breakages. So I like it as a value share. I think it's too cheap. But we're just having to be patient.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's 8.5 times PE, and I think it pays almost a 6% dividend yield. So, it's good value. There's no doubt about it. Okay, good. Yeah. We've got in the same sector, we've got Rebecca. She's asking about Halfords. And did they come out with a trading statement or some numbers today? She's suggesting is there a turnaround in there potentially?
It's possible. It's not too bad, actually, Halfords. Yeah, H1 results, shares were down 2% late morning today. Basically flat. PBT was flat on last year. My main issue with Halfords is the margin is so small. It only makes about a 2% PBT margin. It's not just, obviously, the big retail sheds. They're also growing the MOT garages side of the business, in line with expectations for March 26 full year. I just can't get excited about it, you know. Where's it going to go? It's just a very low margin business. 6% dividend yield is all very well, but when you're eking out a tiny, teeny 2% profit margin, that makes your divvies potentially vulnerable, doesn't it? If, you know, there's a downturn in demand. So I just can't get excited about it, I'm afraid. I think there's better, higher margin retailers. Although Halfords, you could argue, it's kind of the last man standing in a way in its sector, isn't it? I can't think of any other major retail groups that compete in that space, maybe just specialists. So just doesn't excite me, basically, Halfords, I'm afraid.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think what the management team, the board need to do is basically split off the retail from their auto service centres, because they've got a good blueprint to improve the returns from their auto centres, which is their Fusion sort of model. And that'll basically generate more income and higher margins. And if you just unbundle that from the retail side, which I'm sure they don't make. I mean, whenever I go into Halfords, I'm the only person in there. So, I mean, it's just, the volume must be just been, you know, terrible. So your return on capital, if they, you know, split it out, I bet on that retail is very low. So if they could ever find a buyer, and even if they gave it the keys away at zero, I'd prefer that. And then just have this service type of business and they'd concentrate on the brand and then become a sort of like a national, you know, auto repair servicing business that will be able to do stuff in the garage, but also come to your home and do it. And then I might be interested, but I just don't personally, I don't like physical retail, which is one of the reasons why I think Pets at Home needs to split off it, to be perfectly honest. It's retail and just have that vets business. And that would just be a totally different animal as an investment, because people like me want one concept to invest in. We don't want two, and particularly where one can drag the other one down.
Yeah, very good points. I mean, the other thing you could say, though, is that we've had 5-6 years now of constant chaos from the pandemic, from supply chains and all depressed consumer demand. If we take a leap of faith and assume that the economy might be humming along nicely in, say, 2 years' time, then with all their fixed costs, the operational gearing on these retailers could come back quite nicely. I don't know, but overall, I just feel with Halfords, every time I look at it, it's a bit sort of meh, you know. I'm not going to double or triple my money on it, probably. Although the market being what the market is, that'll probably now be precisely what happens.
Okay, let's move sectors. Go to the city, basically, financial advice. We've got Andrew. He's asking about a team who have just bought, I think, or just agreed an all-stock merger with WH Ireland this morning, which, if it goes through, will create a unified sort of like ultra high net worth platform, sort of advising individuals both in the UK, which is WH Ireland, and you've got obviously Team, which is in Jersey based, etc. The shares have responded pretty well, actually. I don't know if you've got any sort of quick thoughts on that at all.
I don't know. WH Ireland has been below my minimum market cap of about 10 million now for quite a long time. So no, I haven't. I don't really cover either of those, I'm afraid, Paul. So sorry.
Yeah, I looked at the actual the statement, and I know they want to go for, I think the combined revenues for both businesses will probably round about sort of 20 million or that sort of like number. They'll be both loss making, but if they can get to where they want to, which is 40 million. of revenues with a 25% EBITDA margins, then I think actually you'll start seeing, you know, that they'll have a market cap as of today, if you joined it, about 30 million. So I think if you did 25% EBITDA margins on 40 million of revenues, you'd probably justify, I'm just guessing here, probably a, I don't know, 60 million. You probably could double your money, I'd have thought. So it all comes down to whether the management teams can actually get execute and join them together, and both, they're both committed, because there's nobody's going away with cash. It's an all share deal.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I used to know quite a lot of the guys who worked at WH Ireland years ago. And I actually had my pension there for a long time, and they're good people, good team there, but it was sort of like attrition, you know. A lot of the people got fed up with the company and the inertia and left, and it's sort of been withering away for many years. So I think merging with another group probably is the right decision. Yeah,
scale up, totally agree. Okay, we've got Paul Bennett, just a general question. He's asking about UK small cap tech, Filtronic and Beaks. He's suggesting, should they list on in the US at all? I've got a strong idea on that one, but what's your view?
They might be too small for the US, possibly. I don't know. But the trouble is the US is very litigious. So I think it's all very well listing out in the... But you get anything wrong, or you're perceived as misleading anyone, you know, they'll have you straight up in court. So I think, whereas anything goes really in AIM, doesn't it? As we painfully are aware. So... I don't know. I mean, one or two companies have done NASDAQ listings or US listings, UK companies. I haven't really monitored them, so I don't know. Does it lead to higher valuations? In theory, it should do, but I don't know if it actually does or not. Is it something you've looked at, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I find if you're a sort of like an established business, it doesn't really. It just increases the, you know, it can increase the liquidity, which is not a massive issue. But in terms of Filtronic and Beaks, they're just too small. They just wouldn't be able, if you're not careful, all you end up doing is splitting the liquidity between the UK investors and the US investors. So in that respect, it wouldn't actually help about, you know, reducing spreads and making it more attractive. I think they need to bulk up. If I was going to say a number, I'd say you've got to have a market cap of at least 500 million even to think about it. And it isn't as though, you know, Filtronic is on a low valuation. And I don't think Beaks is on a low valuation either. No. So it isn't as though they're ignored by UK investors. So I would say it'd be a mistake. It'd distract the management team. They want to carry on growing very rapidly organically. And if they get into a nice position where they get become 500 million market cap companies, then that's a nice problem to have in a couple of years' time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, to be fair, as far as I'm aware, I don't think either Beaks or Filtronic has indicated that they want to do this. Certainly Beaks hasn't. He's made it quite clear, the founder of Beaks, he just wants to sell the thing. But he wants to double, you know, he said basically the earnings are going to double over the next 2 or 3 years. So he's waiting to get a big number that he's penciled in, which I think, you know, reading between the lines, I think he wants to get £1 billion for it.
For
Beaks.
Okay, well, he's got a bit of weight for that one. Okay, we got Matthew Roberts. He's asking about Warpaint, the Challenger Cosmetics. We had one of its rivals, Revolution Beauty, coming out with the results today, actually, as well, saying they are seeing an uptick heading into Christmas, haven't given the founders come back. But anyway, what was your take on your latest on Warpaint?
Well, Warpaint, I bought some of these, just do the opposite of what I do, basically. I bought some of these at £2.80, then it dropped to £2.30, I think, and I doubled up. So I daren't buy any more. I must admit, I kind of had the stuffing knocked out of me a bit on this. I think it's oversold. And the CEO, I did interview him, actually, on a public podcast, where he said... you know, he gave very good explanations for what had gone wrong, and that it was basically their biggest customer temporarily destocking. But he said, look, we get the EPOS data through from their tills, and we know our gear is selling really well. So he said, we're certain it's just a timing glitch. So, I mean, he seemed to give what I thought were very, very convincing reasons for why war paint would, gather its poise and go back up again. But I think the market, you can see from the chart, people have just been selling, haven't they? But I think we shouldn't fall into this assumption that the market always knows best. A lot of it is just sentiment and momentum-driven trading. Sometimes it's followed up by a profit warning. Sometimes it's followed up by a good update. So you just don't know, do you? But certainly at the current valuation, war paint, I think, looks very attractive. The one thing really that sticks in my mind that came out from my chat to the CEO was I hadn't realised just how highly concentrated its business is with one big European retailer. I didn't know that. And that was a mistake on my part, because it's probably buried in the annual report somewhere. Or you could get ChatGPT to write up a thing about client concentration, couldn't you? Probably make half of it up. But
which retailer is that one? Do you know?
It's based in Denmark or Scandinavia. And I said, well, I wouldn't have thought that the Scandinavian market. He said, no, they sell it, or they have branches all over Europe. So, but I can't remember the name of it. But it was a big chunk of their business. It was kind of, I'm thinking almost a third of their revenue was with one customer, which is quite a big risk, isn't it? So, and I think there were also competitive worries amongst investors for, is it an American business called Elf, ELF? I think that is, but I wouldn't be surprised if the next update from Warpaint is reassuring, because they're right at the low end of the market anyway, with value for money, decent quality, popular products that have very good repeat buying from the end customers. So I've not thrown in the towel on Warpaint at all. I've got some myself, and I'm gonna stick with it, see what happens.
Yeah, I think that's personally, I wouldn't be putting a new position on in anything of sort of Challenger Cosmetic, because they're all saying it's really tough at the moment, and it just smells to me is it ain't going to turn very, very quickly. I mean, I could be wrong. I actually think there are more there's more competition from online or whatever it is. I don't know, which is actually could dampening down purchases in store, which is where they make most of their money. I don't think we've reached the bottom on cosmetic sales, actually, but I could be wrong.
War Paint also said that they aren't continuing with retailer rollouts. They've got retailers will put the products into, say, 100 stores, then they sell well, and then they do more. And they did say, look, we've got rollouts happening. So it strikes me that there's no evidence the business is broken or even badly damaged, I think. So based on what we currently know, I think war paint could be quite interesting, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yep. No, I agree. Okay. We got Ray Stewart. He's asking about Hilton Foods. I know we talked about it, but I think they just basically kicked out their CEO. So this is what we talked about at the start. I think is the reputation of the business better than the reputation of the CEO coming in? If they have announced it, I don't know. Is it basically the question comes down to is this a turnaround opportunity in Hilton Foods?
Well, we've never liked it. It's just too low margin. So no, I could never see why anybody particularly. I think this is the one where, we had a mild profit warning on the 11th of November, but the shares, I think, were quite badly beaten up, weren't they? Yeah, they dropped 24% on the day to £4.88. Do we have a current price on those, Paul?
Yeah, it's £5.07.
Oh, okay. So it's bounced a little bit then from there. Yeah, I mean, no, it just doesn't interest me. It's too low margin. No, it's definitely not the sort of thing you'd buy either, is it, Paul?
No, I mean, it hasn't got any pricing power, and it gets caught between commodity prices for beef and pork, as we talked about, plus obviously supermarkets wanting to actually push prices down to attract customers. Yeah. And there's very little added value in terms of supplying, strips of meat into supermarkets. And you don't get economies of scale. You don't seem to anyway. I mean, that's why you get the margin so small. So I'm with you. I just think you've got you're in a tough space with two very powerful supplier and customer at either end. You're going to get squeezed.
You're right. You? You're absolutely right. I mean, this is something I've discovered quite late, really, in my investing journey, which is that sometimes you need to just pull back from all the numbers and just think about the business model and say, is this an attractive business model? You know, in really simple helicopter overview on it. And that way you can quickly just dispense with the vast majority of share ideas, which saves you a lot of time.
Yeah. Good. Okay, we've got another one you consume. We've got a franchise. We've got Damien is asking about Cake Box, which is the sort of like the all fresh cream cake that goes into shops and stuff. And then they bought another business, Asian Sweets and Desserts, Embala, I think it is. Anyway, they came out with some results. The shares have done really well, actually, over the last 2 years.
Yeah, we've this was on Wednesday, yesterday. Yeah, we actually dropped it. We were on 5-star green on it. We've dropped it to 4-stars. We just decided we were being a little bit over generous. Not a bad business, Cake Box. I think the key, the USP is they're egg-free cakes, aren't they? That is the main USP, which apparently I think appeals to certain religious groups, something like that. And anyway, the H1 results came out. They weren't great. EPS was down 11.5%, but still rolling out new stores. And of course, the franchisees pay for the new stores. So it's a nice capital light business model. Balance sheet's okay. And on track for the full year. We think it's on a P of about 15. You've got a very nice yield. The dividend yield's good, 5%. We think it's quite good. But because there are lots of other shares available that have just got much, much cheaper over the past few months, we don't think Cake Box really stands out as a particular bargain. So, like I say, we still like it, but we've dropped it from green to ambergreen purely on valuation. So you've followed this quite closely over the years.
Yeah, I mean, one of their USPs is egg-free, but the biggest one is they're just fabulous cakes. They're just dead fresh. They're dead fresh. The cream is absolutely lovely. I mean, my family's had them all the time. And I think the egg-free definitely helps if you've got sort of like, you know, religious beliefs that can't have eggs, no doubt about it. But frankly, I think they get lots of, you know, people who are non-religious in there and just like myself and just want a really lovely cake at a really good price. And I think that's really where they do, you know, that's where their difference is. Because if you get a big you get a Colin the Caterpillar from, I don't know, basically from Tesco's or whatever it is, or M&S, I mean, it's okay, but it's nothing like this. And if you want a special occasion and to celebrate your birthday or something like that, then it's the go-to place to get a really nice big family treat. So I think that's where they're they're doing well. I mean, for a franchise business, I was just looking at the numbers and they traded about sort of like 9x EBITDA going forward. But that's obviously as they've got some extra costs with Embala, they're integrating. But these businesses will typically go for 13 or 14 times EBITDA on a takeover. And I've always thought why don't they, you know, sort of replicate some of the strategy and franchise it out overseas, because they've got a sufficient scale and a blueprint to be able to do that in the UK. They know what they're doing. And, you know, you do it so like, you know, Domino's Pizza out in the States sells it, you know, franchises to other countries and just takes a clip and you basically help set them up. So I think the owner founder, Soup Chandal, I mean, I know he loves it, but at some point he will want to retire. And, you know, not a bad time to go out at the top, you know, I suppose. Mm,
yeah, exactly. And there were takeover rumours from Australia, weren't there, a little while ago, I think, some time ago.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, it was the Australian Cheesecake Boys, wasn't it? But I think they put about 170 on it and it was obviously rejected because it was just too low. Okay, good. Yeah. We've got, who was it, basically? We had somebody else asking about Saga, now it's a travel agent, not a travel agent. It runs those ships. I can't remember. I can't remember who. One guy is asking about. Oh, it's right. Yeah, Julian Spence. Sorry. What was your latest on this?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, I met Julian at Mellow, actually. Hello, Julian. Yes, I think he was talking to me about Saga. Apparently, Alex, another chap, Alex with a Y. He did a presentation apparently at Mellow saying that he saw Saga as a 5 or 10 bagger or something, which made me wonder what he'd been smoking. But I don't. I mean, we've followed Saga for many, many years, and I was bullish on it when it was a pound a share, but eventually gave up. And of course, Sod's Law being what it is, it's more than doubled more recently. I mean, my main thing on Saga was that the debt was not going to kill it, because most of the debt was related to the cruise ships, which is just asset funding. So I think I can credibly claim that my thesis about the debt was actually proven correct in the long run. But I'm skeptical about whether you need a brand for old people, because I think Silver Surfers these days are internet savvy. They'll buy their car insurance where it's cheapest. I don't think they need to go, oh, let's go to Saga, you know, we can trust them, or anything like that. You know, I think those days are long gone. So, but the holiday division and the cruises, the reviews of them are fantastic. And it is a premium price, premium margin product. So, maybe Julian is right that we should be looking at it as a quality sort of travel business. And I think the insurance part, didn't they divest the underwriting part? I have a feeling. And I think they've de-risked the other part of the insurance side. Owner managed, of course, Sir Roger Dahan came back and is running it. So I can't get excited about it. You've had a lovely re-rating on it in the last year. It's not something I'd be chasing at this level personally.
Yeah. You're wasted doing stock picking. That was a fantastic impersonation. You should go into a theatre or something. You're absolutely brilliant. Maybe pantomime.
You're not the first person who... Yeah, you pantomime. Yeah, no, you're not the first person who said that, actually.
Okay, let's just go. We've got a couple of more. We've got Chris is asking about Senior, which is basically an aerospace business that's spinning off its aero structures. And I think it leaves itself with Flextronics and it's another part of its aerospace, which is cables, I think, and stuff. What was your take? I think they came out, they increased their guidance, but I think the shares went down on the day, actually, if I remember rightly.
That's my recollection as well. Yeah, we couldn't understand that. There must have been something in the detail that the market didn't like. I mean, looking at the share price today for Senior, looks, you know, priced about right. Forward PE of 23 times is certainly not a bargain, is it? And it's got a bit of debt. You've only got a 1.6 dividend yield percent. So it doesn't, on those basic numbers, doesn't look particularly exciting, but it's a nice sector, isn't it? Aerospace. I think there's might be some defense work in there as well. I mean, it's kind of gone sideways, hasn't it, for the last 4 to 5 years? Well, you know, oscillations, but on a sideways trend. So can't get madly excited about it. But I have a feeling, as you say, the last update was reasonably good, I think. Mm.
Yeah, and I think the only reason why I think it went down on the day, and it's obviously just clutching at straws, but they did say in the statement that the aerostructures business that they're selling is being sold by the end of the year on an EBITDA multiple, and they just started to see some delays on deliveries and contract execution, which means if they exit at a lower EBITDA in 2025 than the market thought, then the total proceeds they'll get, because it's a multiplier, will just be on the maths,
right?
And then you get less cash coming in. So I think that's what the market sort of like sold it off on. But the other two parts of the business, their core businesses, are doing very well. I mean, that's why they upgraded.
Well, thanks for clarifying that, Paul. That's good information. I wasn't aware of that. So yeah.
Okay, good. We've got the last one. Let's go for life sciences. Really cheap company. We've got Mandy. She's asking about Cuth, which is basically the UK's biggest mental health sort of like provider for mental health services provider for in the UK for sort of like students and young adults, and then won that massive contract out in the States with California. The share, they did a big fundraise when they won that California at about £3. The shares have just been hammered over the last few years. Really, really cheap. Lots of bad news in that price at the moment. What was your take anyway?
I just can't make my mind up on this. I did buy some a little while ago after one of your fund manager interviews, actually, where the guy extolled the virtues of it, saying it was, you know, a really good risk reward type thing. It's made a very small acquisition, which it said was not material. That's the last news we had on Cuth. The big problem is you've got such heavy client concentration on that California contract. And I know it's got one or two other contracts, but it's just almost impossible to value it. And also, I didn't like the fact that they did have a large cash pile, but they've burnt quite a bit of it on marketing, I think, marketing spend to kind of prop up the big contract, I think, by getting more people to use the app or the service. So I think there are credible bull and bear arguments on this. And I had to admit defeat on it, Paul, and just say, I just don't know. I just don't know. That's it, really, on this. I think you can argue it either way. Do you have a strong view?
Yeah, I mean, it looks sillily priced. I mean, I was just looking at the numbers. It's currently trading at about 45 times. Its market cap is about 45 million. It's got 20 million of cash, which obviously that supported the contract. But I think it's cash neutral. So it comes out about 25 million market cap. Its sales, if you on an ongoing basis, including the California contract, is 65 million. So it puts it at a 0.4 sales and about 2.5 times EBITDA. Now, if it lost that contract, it would lose about half of its sales, because that's about 50%. And that would take the sales down to roughly round about, what, just doing the maths, 33 million. And therefore, compared to an EV of 25 million, it would still be cheap, as long as you could right size that 33, because of the, you know, you take out your cost in California if you did it, then it still looks cheap, even if it lost it. I don't know what the probability is of retaining that contract next year. But all I would say is that even if they don't, I don't think there's that much downside, which is implying that, you know, the shares are just saying that is going to lose it, and therefore you do have an optionality in almost getting this renewal in for free. It is definitely well thought of in the UK. It's by far and away the biggest mental health provider all through schools, and they continue to use it. They just don't make much money out of the UK. That's the problem.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a figure of 15 million net cash at June, and I have a feeling they've indicated they're going to burn some of that cash. So, that cash side of your numbers might need revisiting. But I just think overall, I just can't value it. I think without really knowing what's going on inside the business, I think only insiders really know how to value this.
No, I would agree. Okay, good. Well, we've been going now for 75 minutes. So thanks again, everyone, for your questions. We've had a bit of a whiz through all the budget and different sectors and lots of different stocks. And so there should be plenty of ideas that people can sort of dig into. And again, obviously, thanks very much for Paul. Are you back from Bahrain next week, or is this just a one?
Yes, I'm flying back on Sunday, I think it is. So I'm off out in half an hour to go to the British Club to have a curry and hobnob with some British expats out here.
you never know. Given what they've been watching this, they might ask you to do the eight half Hopman sort of an impression.
yes. Well, I'm gonna take a few orange pens with me, my Substack pens, and see if I can give out a few pens to people. So.
Okay. All right, brilliant. Okay, well, thanks again, guys, and look for same time, same place next week.
Great. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints. Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.